This is number 0062, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0062. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Robert Schnackenberg, who is a very prolific writer with many books out there on various topics and in various shapes and sizes. What makes him write so much and on such diverse topics?
Yeah, I really want to cover people, you know, from soup to nuts, something you can read, you know, on the john, you know, something you have to kind of carry with you in a case, and as you say, something you can stuff in a pocket and, you know, read on the train or on the subway. So it's important to me to diversify my books in terms of size and material.
Darren Campo is a television producer and executive. He's currently the senior vice president of True TV and the author of Alex Details Revolution and its sequel, Alex Details Rebellion. How different is it creatively to be a television executive as opposed to being a writer?
All storytelling from television shows, movies, involves so many people, and it becomes so many people's story. And so, right, working in television at True TV, we make almost 500 different shows a year, and they're collaborative efforts. So to have an opportunity to sit and tell a story that's just your story, it's a very different kind of storytelling, and I think it really hones all of your creative juices.
Mark McIntyre is the guy at home in his underwear. You can see him online as he raises money and awareness in the fight against testicular cancer. He's also a survivor.
I was lucky because it was detected early, so I never had to fear for my life. And it was a little bit uncomfortable to lose a testicle for sure, but you know what? I was one of the lucky ones, and that's why I want to spread this word so that people check their testicles and get early detection so that they can have an easy time as I did.
And of course, lots and lots and lots of stuff, and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0062, is Michelle St. Cyr from the television production company Group Fairplay. He's been an executive producer on many Canadian shows, both in French and English. Some of the shows I've been involved in as either host, correspondent, or writer. Some of those shows include Canadian Case Files, Guy Stuff, Destiny Files, Mystery Inc., just to name a few, and a show that I hosted for 8 years, Soul Call. So thank you very much, Michelle, for doing the slate on this edition of The Stuff File. Looking forward to your next call when you hire me again. Anyway, let's get to the stuff. Actually, before we get to the stuff, I just want to mention a couple of things. We have a new station on board for The Stuff File. WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, just below the 49th parallel from us here in Montreal. Hello to all of our listeners in the Green Mountain State. You get to hear the show on Friday night at midnight. Hope you enjoy it. And a special hello to Bob Welsh from WSTJ. Also, there is now a Stuff File online store. If you want to be the first on your block to own your very own Stuff File apparel, like t-shirts, for instance, or drink your hot beverage of choice from a Stuff File mug, then visit the Stuff File store. You'll find the link right on the front page of the website at thestufffile.com. Go ahead, buy some Christmas gifts. Shop now, shop often, shop early. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Oh, here's your pro tip of the day. Get to know your motorhome. In Dufferin Springs, Florida, a 55-year-old woman suffered serious injuries after she fell out of a motorhome that was zooming down Interstate 10. Now, apparently, Sharon R. Glover walked to the rear of the motorhome to use the restroom, but it's believed that she may have opened the wrong door, the one leading to the outside. So she hit the pavement hard and skidded about 100 feet on the paved emergency lane before hitting the grass shoulder. The driver, 50-year-old Bonnie J. Rickett, noticed that Glover had fallen out of the motorhome and pulled off the road about a quarter of a mile from where she hit the ground. It's also believed that Ms. Glover may have been drinking. See? Once again, alcohol is the cause. Moving right along, Sharon Brown, age 23, happened to be walking through a Brooklyn, New York neighborhood back in August. at the exact moment that a tractor trailer accidentally clipped a light pole, sending it crashing to the sidewalk. Fire responders found Brown pinned under the pole, screaming for help, and had her taken to hospital. Afterwards, investigators discovered a nearby surveillance camera, which revealed that Brown had stepped out of the way of the falling pole, but then, with no one around to see her, had crawled underneath and began wailing in pain, perhaps in anticipation of a future lawsuit. But as you know, folks, nowadays so many street corners are on surveillance cam, so smile, you're on candid camera. Nice going there, Sharon. Nice going. Okay, a 15-year-old boy in Rocky Point, New York, had been robbed of his bicycle, and he told this to police. The suspect's descriptions were rather distinct. Two were dressed in gorilla costumes, and one of them punched him in the head. When the boy fell off of his bicycle, a third suspect, wearing a chicken suit, jumped on the bike and rode off. Well, of course, the one who ran off was a chicken. Go figure. What are the odds? They should be hard to find, don't you think? Anyway, about 100 city employees of Oklahoma City had to vacate their office space because of mold issues that were creating serious health hazards. Now, this in itself wouldn't be that big of a story, except for the fact that the office space we're talking about was that of the State Board of Health. The agency recently had started leasing parts of a 50-year-old building that was once the house of Lucite Technologies. But a little over a week ago, cleanup crews could be seen entering and leaving the building. Health department officials think most of the mold in the building came from the agency's former offices that flooded earlier this year. They believe the mold came from files that had been moved to the new offices. So let me get this straight. The State Board of Health brought the mold with them to the new building. They're traveling with mold. Yes, there's a fungus among us. Anyway, they believe, as I said, the mold came from their old offices, and they're now vowing to make sure health department employees are working in a healthy and safe environment, and the agency now is looking at finding new office space. So, there you go. Now, just how bad is the economy? Apparently, wives are now robbing their own husbands at gunpoint. At least that's what happened in Cincinnati, where Stephanie Fall allegedly pointed a gun at her own husband, Madhu Fall, and demanded cash. Officers said Stephanie threatened to shoot her husband if he didn't comply. She's now been charged with domestic violence. Hey to go there, Stephanie. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest, police in Neenah, Wisconsin, were summoned to an apartment building. A man was trying to run over someone in the parking lot, a witness reported. Officers got there quickly, since the building is across the street from the police station. Sure enough, Bryce A. Hinkle, age 28, was still behind the wheel of his car. Witnesses say he had been trying to run down his ex-girlfriend's fiancé. Hinkle was charged with attempted first-degree intentional homicide and operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated, which, by the way, this was his fourth offense in 5 years for just that alone. Now, here's the part where it gets weird. Hinkle admitted he had been drinking. His ex said he had been drinking anything with alcohol that he could get his hands on. Vodka, vanilla extract, food coloring. Sure enough, Hinkle's lips, tongue, and teeth were stained blue-green from the alcohol-based colors that he had been imbibing. Wow, he should get a book perhaps on mixed drinks. And oh, that's a subtle segue to our first guest on the Stuff File program. Robert Schnackenberg is a very prolific writer. He has several books out there. There's DC Comics' 75th Anniversary Poster Book. There's also Secret Lives of Great Filmmakers and Old Man Drinks. Robert joins us on the line right now. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Hi, Peter. I'm good.
It's great to have you back on the program. We had you on the old radio show on a couple of occasions. I believe back then we were talking about two other totally different books, the Encyclopedia Shatnerica we talked to you about when we first spoke to you, and also The Secret Lives of Great Authors. So you just keep churning these books out, don't you?
I do. It's not so bad, for government work, I guess, as they say. You know, it pays the bills, and my publisher keeps employing me, so they keep coming me with interesting ideas for books, and I keep saying yes. So that's how we end up here.
And I have three of the books, the three titles I just mentioned in the introduction. I have three of the books sitting in front of me here, and They certainly do come in all shapes and sizes, from a book that can fit into my pocket to another book that I need an easel to read it with.
Yeah, I really want to cover people, you know, from soup to nuts, something you can read, you know, on the john, you know, something you have to kind of carry with you in a case, and as you say, something you can stuff in a pocket and, you know, read on the train or on the subway. So it's important to me to diversify my books in terms of size and material.
Okay, well, let's talk about the big one first, DC Comics 75th Anniversary Poster Book. This is an absolutely beautiful book, and I guess it certainly is designed for anybody who has or is has been or is a fan of comic books.
Exactly. It's the 75th anniversary of DC Comics this year, and they kind of came to my publisher and said they wanted to do a bunch of books to celebrate it, and one of the ones that they particularly interested in was a poster book, which is of the great covers spanning all 75 years of DC Comics history. And the innovation that we came up with was to make it so you could actually tear the covers out of the book in the form of a poster. So we've kind of blown up some of the iconic and interesting covers from DC Comics history and perforate the pages so you can actually remove them from the book and frame them and put them up on your wall. So it's a really gorgeous book.
Well, the thing I'm wondering is as you say, there's 75 years of so many cover arts out there. How do you whittle it down to what's actually in this book?
Well, we knew that our number was going to be around 100 or 101 covers. So we came up with a list. There were certain ones there were absolute no-brainers, you know, Action Comics number one, and the first appearance of Batman in the pages of Detective Comics had to be in there, and some more recent stuff like Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns, which comic book fans will, of course, know and would always want to have in a book of this sort. So we had the no-brainers, and then we kind of branched out from there, and we came up with a list that included some really weird ones, you know, from, you know, the early 70s, you know, where Lois Lane is transformed into an African-American woman for a day, and some of the other great ones, like the Green Arrow, Green Lantern comic, where, you know, Green Arrow's sidekick Speedy becomes a heroin addict. So there were ones that had camp value. So we just added those in to the ones that were iconic and had to be in there. And eventually, we came up with a list of more than 100, and we ended up having to pare that list down just to get to fit it inside the book. Mm.
Okay, so that's another great book, and again, it's huge. I didn't even bother measuring it. What's the size of this book? It's what would you say the size of this book is?
I don't have it in front of me. I don't know what the trim size is. That's kind of that's beyond my ken. But it's large. It's half a man tall, I would say.
It's about a foot and a half high. To about
maybe the size of Hervé Villechaize, I would say.
Absolutely. Now, I want to go from comic books to another book of yours, which has a comic book-like cover, but is a totally different thing, and that is The Secret Lives of Great Filmmakers. And as I said in the introduction, or early in our chat, we had you on the program with The Secret Lives of Great Authors, so I guess this is a continuation, sort of that vein?
Exactly. This is a continuation, I think, possibly the culmination of this series, which is kind of started off with another author doing one on American presidents, and then I kind of came in and took it in the direction of authors, and we're kind of continuing to move into a pop culture direction now with filmmakers. So it's 40-odd of the great directors of movie history, all the great names, the Martin Scorsese's, the Alfred Hitchcock's, the Charlie Chaplin's are in there, and we kind of tear the veil off some of these great directors and talk about some of their odd proclivities and hobbies and habits, just as we've done in the other books in the series. And it's kind of a fun compendium of trivia about, you know, the weirder and darker side of some of the great filmmakers in history.
Now, with these great filmmakers in history, of course, quite a few of them are dead, but there are some, like you mentioned, Scorsese, who is alive. Have you heard from any of the great filmmakers who are maybe not necessarily too amused or don't mind their stories being in your book?
No, the only one I really feared that I might hear from was Spike Lee, and because of his pugnacious personality and because I was none too complimentary about him in his chapter, but I seem to have skated away from any kind of cease and desist order, just as I've done on my previous books. Maybe it's just a function of the fact that I screen my calls and never answer my phone, but nobody has successfully gotten in touch with me, let's put it that way.
Okay, so you mentioned Spike Lee. What did you say about Spike? What's his big secret?
Well, the only thing that I kind of resent about Spike is his constant portrayal of himself as being from Brooklyn and from the hood, when he really hasn't lived there in a long time. He bought a house that Jasper Johns used to own on the Upper East Side, and that's where he lives most of the time. And then he and his wife also have a palatial estate at Martha's Vineyard. So I love Spike's movies. I mean, I think he's an interesting personality, and I agree with a lot of what he says. But, I mean, I also think he's a little bit of a phony when it comes to all the from Brooklyn stuff. So I did call him out on that and mention some of the feuds that he's had with other filmmakers like Clint Eastwood in the book, and I kind of chronicle all those. And I think if you read all that, you probably wouldn't come away with a positive impression of Spike, although, as a media personality, I love him because he creates such controversy, but I could see how he might be offended.
Okay, so I'm sure you have your own favorite filmmakers. In putting this book together, what did you discover about one of your favorites?
Well, there's a lot of stuff in there that kind of surprised me. I mean, some really weird stuff that was kind of under the radar that I didn't know about. Like, Robert Altman is a favorite director of mine, the great director of MASH and Gosford Park and a bunch of the movies. And I was interested to find that he actually once worked as a personalized dog tattoo artist back in the 40s. This is after he got out of the Army. He was just kind of knocking around looking for work, and the guy who sold him his dog had this idea for a business where, we'll tattoo dogs with an identity number so their owners can find them if they get lost. And it was kind of an early GPS system. And Altman just loved the idea. He thought it would be a total million-dollar-making business proposition. So he went into business with this guy. And Robert Altman's job was to actually shave the dogs, put on some antiseptic, and tattoo the identifying number on the inside of the dog's groin. So he actually even tattooed Harry Truman's dog in Washington, D.C. as part of a publicity stunt to promote it. And sadly, the business didn't go anywhere. But that's one story that I think, is probably not to be found in too many biographies that is in my book.
Okay. So that book is called The Secret Lives of Great Filmmakers. And we just have a few minutes, but I want to get to the smallest book here, which is called Old Man Drinks. Tell us a little bit about this one.
This is a collection of drink recipes. I drink in my spare time periodically, and I guess my publisher thought I would be the ideal person to sort of compile a collection of recipes of what you would call old man drinks, the real old-fashioned, in fact, including the old-fashioned, the old-fashioned, the gimlets, the mint juleps, the rusty nails, the kind of recipes that, hard-bitten old men drank or still drink when they congregate in bars today. And so what we've done is we've compiled these recipes, and we've included quotations from actual old men in bars that I and some of my correspondents went out into watering holes around the country and talked to old men and got them to say kind of politically incorrect, weird, strange, and sometimes very wise and insightful things. And we compiled the best of those quotations, and they're on the facing pages with photographs, and they're on the facing pages with the recipes for the drinks.
Since you say they're old man drinks, are these drinks that are dying out, or is there a resurgence or a rebirth of some of these drinks, and they're popular again, or have they always been popular in some cases?
Well, they've always been popular with me in my house. I mean, the Cure Royale never goes out of style. I'm a big fan of the gimlet. But I think they are coming back. I mean, I think there's a whole retro cocktail wave that's coming in now. I think it's sort of piggybacking on the whole Mad Men retro, 50s and 60s thing. And a lot of these are coming back. There are a lot of bars specializing in these kind of cocktails. So hopefully we're kind of tapping into the zeitgeist for that. And then people are going to be heading into their local bar and ordering a monkey gland or a Manhattan or what have you on the basis of that. And this book is a great preference for people who want to make those drinks at home.
The book is called Old Man Drinks, and it's yet another book that's out there by Robert Schnakenberg. And how many books do you have altogether?
Well, including the ones that I was too ashamed to put my name on, probably over 20 at this point. You know, it's at least 7, I think, for this particular publisher, Quirk Books out of Philadelphia, which does a lot of my stuff. So it's a large and growing corpus of work, which I think will hold me in good stead when I'm no longer on this planet. Mm.
Well, with all the writing that you do and how busy you keep, I'm very thankful that we had the chance to talk to you and get it, crack into your busy schedule a little bit. Thank you very much, Robert, for being on the program with us once again.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Robert Schnackenberg, author of 3 books that are currently out there and several others. Again, the various titles we've been talking about here today were DC Comics' 75th Anniversary Poster Book, Secret Lives of Great Filmmakers, and Old Man Drinks. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0062, and you'll find links to Robert's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the books directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet television producer and author Darren Campo, plus Mark McIntyre, the guy at home in his underwear. And of course, we have an idiot of the day. But first, more stuff right here, right now. And this story comes under the headline of Another Baby Needs His Bottle. An unnamed man in Madison, Wisconsin, called police to report he was robbed of a bottle of brandy. He bought the booze and shortly afterward was robbed of the brandy and his wallet at knife point by 2 men that he intended to share it with, according to police spokesperson Joel Despain. A police dog followed the trail and found 2 backpacks, but the robbers got away. The brandy was in 1 backpack, Despain said, but the victim became very upset when informed that it was evidence and he wouldn't be getting it back immediately. Perhaps upset doesn't quite cover it. The 50-year-old man threw a tantrum, lying in the street, demanding police return his booze. When officers ignored the request, the man made a number of 911 calls to report his missing bottle and was arrested for making false crime reports. There you go. Alcohol, again, was the cause. Okay, we go to Walmart for our next story because, as you know, if you listen to this program regularly, most bizarre stories seem to originate from Walmart. A Walmart store in Alliance, Ohio, called police to report a man had wheeled an estimated $1,000 worth of merchandise out of the store without paying for it. When officers arrived, they chased after the suspect but lost him in the darkness. They searched for 40 minutes before a frantic 911 call came in. That frantic call went something like this. I'm in the back of a trash truck that keeps compacting me. Yeah, that call came in from James Brienzo, age 37, who apparently had hidden himself from police in a trash dumpster, which was picked up minutes later. He was pretty well compacted by the time officers found the right truck, said Police Chief Scott Griffith. Brienzo was so intertwined with the 6 to 8 tons of trash that the truck had to dump its load to free him, and he was hospitalized in critical condition. His arrest record filled 26 pages, including a previous arrest at the same Walmart. You think he learned his lesson this time? Nah, me neither. Yeah. Okay, moving right along. A Boulder, Colorado man accused of attempted murder of a Longmont police officer has had his day in court. Brandon Duke, age 22, told investigators that he believed that Officer David Blake was a zombie. Blake was trying to arrest Duke on an outstanding warrant, and Duke fired several shots from a handgun at Blake in his attempts to get away, according to court records. Duke testified that he had blacked out and couldn't remember what happened, but thought he was being chased by a zombie and had fired only to protect himself. At his court appearance, where he addressed the judge simply as yes ma'am and no ma'am, Duke pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. Gee, if he had said yes, Mistress of the Darkness, and no, Mistress of the Darkness, he'd have helped his case immensely, I think. Okay, that's definitely under the headline of Night of the Living Dumb. Anyway, and that didn't make Idiot of the Day, by the way. That comes later in the program. On to our next story, we go to Beijing, a Chinese man who got his arm stuck in a toilet pipe in an attempt to retrieve his dropped mobile phone was freed by rescuers. When rescue workers arrived on the scene in Jiangsu province in eastern China, they found the man crouched over the toilet in a bathroom stall, his entire arm submerged up to the shoulder in the drain. Workers broke the porcelain bowl with crowbars and hammered the pipes, taking care not to injure the man. After 10 minutes of work, the man was able to slowly remove his cut and bruised arm from the bowl and retrieve his waterlogged phone. Now, I've said this time and time again. I don't know about you folks, but my phone drops into a toilet. That's the last time I'm putting that thing to my ear. It's done. It's gone. It's finished. That's just the way I feel about it. Okay, finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Catholics may very well find themselves sweating in the confessional box, but that's not what's supposed to happen. A church in Vienna is undergoing renovations and is selling off a few items on eBay, namely an old confessional. It's advertised as ideal for conversion into a one-person sauna, a small bar, or a children's playhouse. But that auction came to an abrupt halt when the archdiocese stepped in. An archdiocese spokesperson said that auctioning, quote, objects that are used to dispense the sacraments is not acceptable, unquote, adding that confessionals should not be converted into saunas or bars. And in a wicked, humorous twist, 40 bidders had bid on the item before it was yanked. The last bid made was 666 euros. Now that's funny. Yes. Okay, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Darren Campo is a television producer and executive. He is currently the senior vice president of True TV. As if television doesn't keep him busy enough, he's also an author. He's written Alex Details Revolution and its sequel, Alex Details Rebellion. Darren is on the line with us right now from New York. Hi, Darren. How are you?
Hi, Peter. I'm great. Thank you.
Thanks for being on with us. Now, a writer and a television executive, are you a television executive who writes or a writer who works in TV?
It depends on what time of the day you catch me. But for now, a television executive who writes.
What is it about the creative process, the writing process, that attracted you to write the books that you've written so far?
Well, you know, because you have a radio show and you've worked in different media before, it's all storytelling from television shows, movies, involves so many people, and it becomes so many people's story. And so right, working in television, True TV, we make almost 500 different shows a year, and they're collaborative efforts. So to have an opportunity to sit and tell a story that's just your story, it's a very different kind of storytelling, and I think it really hones all of your creative juices.
Now, you've done what is basically, I guess you can call it, well, sci-fi is what mm-hmm. it is. What made you go into that genre? Had you always been a sci-fi fan, or is this just something that just came to you?
I've always been a sci-fi fan. I think it's, when I was a kid growing up, the kinds of books I read, they sort of take you out of this time and place and open you up to other possibilities. and stretch the imagination a little bit so that you're not bound by the sort of the restrictions of today's beliefs and technology.
Even though science fiction does take you out of this time and place, and the best science fiction usually is telling a very contemporary story. So what are you saying about today's society through what you've written with the Alex Detail stories?
Really, the main story is a very familiar tale. Alex Detail is he was a child genius, and he won a war, and it takes place 250 years from now against some invaders. They're not quite sure what they are or who they are. But he's now 17 in this book, and he doesn't quite have the brilliance he had as a kid. But he's still forced to go out and fight a war. And that's sort of the thing that should be familiar to everybody, is that you always feel like you've done enough. But society, your family, anything, something always calls on you to do just a little bit more. And that's the journey that we're all on.
Now, a lot of times when people write, they say, write what you know. How much of Darren Campo is in Alex Detail?
I think there's a lot of it in Alex Detail, and I think there's a lot of it in the other characters in the book. There's a captain of the ship who's obsessed with food because she doesn't know how to deal with other people's emotions, and there's first officer who's a very, very religious woman. She has absolutely no problem with anything. She has all the answers, and probably the sort of the calmest, most balanced character. And there's a sort of a megalomaniac world ruler who's she seems very motherly, but sort of is blind to her own evil ways, as it were.
Well, you work as a television executive. Sometimes, as a television executive, I'm sure many projects come across your desk. Is Alex Detail something you'd like to see on the screen, either small or big? And what would you say as an executive if it came across your desk?
Well, if it came across my desk as an executive, I'd say, make this movie. It's genius. But, you know, what happens, again, if someone were to take Alex Detail and make it into a movie, it would be their story, and I would be happy to let them do it. But you have to let it go and say, you know, it's not yours anymore, because now it's going to be a lot of people rewriting the story. You know, you've read a book and then gone to see the movie and compared the two, and you see the process it goes through, be it written for one audience and then a movie made for another audience. So.
You did the first one, Alex Detail's Revolution, and now the sequel, Alex Detail's Rebellion. Was it your intent when you first started writing that it would be a series?
You know, when you're writing something, you don't really know. You don't really know how far it's going to go. But if you're really getting into, I think, an authentic story, and you're really digging into something new, there's always another story that can be told from it. And I really thought that once I got to the end of this book, there was one character in particular who I felt needed, and I felt as a writer, needed his story to be told further out, and that was really the genesis of the second book.
And now that you have the second book, will you continue?
I do want to write a third book, and I don't know, until you're done with the book. And again, as a kid, I always read trilogies. Everything was a trilogy. So there was a certain, in a science fiction trilogy, a certain story arc that was almost like following an act structure. And when I make TV shows, they're either four acts or six acts. And there's a convention that the reader or the viewer comes to expect. So three sounds like a nice number, and it's something I'm familiar with.
When you write, do you know where you're going story-wise, or do you learn what happens to the characters as you write it?
I know where I'm starting, and I know where I'm going. I don't know what happens in between. And there are certain things I think will happen. I think one character will do one thing, or will end up, you know, in cahoots with another character, and they do a whole different thing. And much of writing is channeling, you know, a story from someplace. It's very hard to articulate, but it's kind of the place where dreams come from. You know, you don't have that much control over some aspects of it.
You have two very distinct jobs, as it were. One as a television executive, one as a writer. How do the two complement each other?
Well, I think the main thing in whatever your piece of entertainment you're doing is entertain people. it's great if there's something deeper that people resonates with people, that moves them or they identify with. But if you're not entertained in the first second of a TV show, first 5 seconds of a TV show, the first paragraph of a book, then you're not, you've not gotten your money's worth. I want to make sure my people who buy the book get their money's worth. And that means when you go into a chapter, it grabs you. And when you go out of a chapter, you can't wait to see what happens next. Same with making a TV show.
Now, since this book is set in the future, I guess we're no longer dealing with airline food. But I understand you have a theory or two on spaceship food.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, there's only one answer, which is food's just going to keep getting worse as we go forward in time, and it gets bioprocessed and created by who knows what. But in my book, it's 250 years from now. Now, I know you've had an astronaut or two and a Star Trek star or two on your show, so they could probably answer the question better than I about the future of space food. But the captain Odessa of the ship in my book, eat, has enormous amounts of food in the most inappropriate places. They're in the middle of a battle. The book opens, and she has hot soup that she's eating and apple fritters. And it's just it's good food, but a very strange combination of food.
Interesting.
You know, I was saying the other day, I was on a flight to a television conference, and they were serving cream of mushroom soup and a Reuben sandwich. And I looked at my boss, who I was traveling with. He said, someone sat in a meeting and thought this would be a good idea to serve on a flight. You're not like a chicken salad or something easy. A Reuben sandwich. Now, I ate both, and I loved them because I really like bad airplane food. So something about that came through in the writing, because there's just this sloppy mess of food on the bridge of a spaceship that the captain is just gorging herself on and forcing others to eat. And the main character, Alex Detail, is just so disgusted by food and doesn't want to have anything to do with it. Now, of course, on a ship, you got to think about what things smell like. Just like on an airplane, you can smell what they're doing, the coffee, and it's, you know, things can get a little off the beaten path if you don't go right. And I saw some astronauts on one of those cooking shows the other day, and they were saying that they never get spicy foods because they're sort of in containers, but they're very concerned about the smell. It's a very small atmosphere they have to be in.
Well, Darren, I'm just curious to know, as a television executive, with this novel, you see things very visually. You have to, as a television executive. When you're writing, do you cast actors in the parts? Do you have them in your mind's
Peter,
eye?
It's an interesting question, but I think afterwards I do think about it, but I almost don't even have a clear picture of what the characters look like at first. They do things, and through their actions, I start to see them. But I've never really come up with actors that I would want to see playing the part. It almost it sort of pulls it down to a level that I'm not thinking of it at.
The book, the latest one, is called Alex Detail's Revolution. It's actually Alex Detail's Rebellion. It's the sequel to Alex Detail's Revolution. And Darren, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Darren Campo, author of Alex Detail's Revolution and its sequel, Alex Detail's Rebellion. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this program, which is show number 0062, and you'll find links to Darren's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones. Thomas Jefferson once said that judges should be a mere machine. What did he mean by that? Well, a machine follows the directions of the maker, so he was saying judges are supposed to follow the directions of legislators who make the law, whether they like the law or not. A lot of political experts these days like to measure judges by whether they're conservative or liberal, but that's really not the correct measuring stick. The role of a judge is to enforce laws that have been constitutionally enacted. A few years ago, a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court explained Jefferson's philosophy like this. She said that if a state's highest court is working as it should, it will issue conservative rulings when conservatives control the legislature, and liberal rulings when liberals are writing the laws. The idea is for judges in the rulings to be predictable. Let's be fair. Judges who set aside politics and enforce the law give institutions and job providers the confidence they need to grow. And that's something America needs now more than ever. Find out more. Go to our website at foundationforfairciviljustice.org.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And coming up on the show, we'll meet a guy in his underwear for a good cause. And, of course, we also have an idiot of the day. But before we get to all of that, one more Stuff File story to get to in the news portion of the program. In Reidsville, North Carolina, police arrested 38-year-old Lonnie Irvin Pinnix for allegedly shooting his wife with toilet paper. Allegedly, Pinnix loaded his pistol with a wad of toilet paper and shot his wife, 55-year-old Darlene Pinnix, in the back after she returned to their home shortly after midnight. Investigators say Darlene lay down on the bed and Lonnie shot her in the back with the toilet paper ammunition when she refused his demands to get back up. Lonnie told deputies he shot his wife because she wouldn't leave. He was charged with assault with a deadly weapon. She was taken to the hospital and treated for powder burns. Maybe Lonnie should be the one who leaves. What do you think? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Mark McIntyre is a survivor of testicular cancer. Besides surviving, Mark decided to do something to raise awareness. So he's spending 25 straight days at home in his underwear, live on camera for everyone to see. And by reaching 50,000 people who will like him on Facebook, Stanfields, which is Canada's underwear company, will donate $50,000 to the Canadian Cancer Society for testicular cancer awareness. You can see him on his website at guyathome.com. Mark joins us via Skype-to-Skype technology from his home in Toronto. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm great, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. And first of all, congratulations for having survived what you went through in the first place.
Thanks a lot, Peter. I mean, it was pretty good. I was lucky because it was detected early, so I never had to fear for my life. Okay. And it was a little bit uncomfortable to lose a testicle for sure. But you know what? I was one of the lucky ones, and that's why I want to spread this word so that people check their testicles and get early detection so that they can have an easy time as I did.
Now, I said in the introduction that you want to reach 50,000 people and Stanfields will donate $50,000, but that has been bumped up, right? Because it was originally 25,000, correct?
That's exactly right. The original idea was that we were going to have me, you know, live in the law for 25 days and remain here. And if I did and got 25,000 likes, then Stanfields would donate the 25,000. But we hit 25,000 likes in 7 days. It went gangbusters. It was it's working really, really well. So John Stanfield called and personally bumped the money to $50,000 the day after.
Are you surprised with how fast you reached that initial goal?
Well, I don't think any of us really knew what to expect. This is the first time anyone's done anything exactly like this. So I think we were hopeful that people would spread the word and that people would jump on board. I think we were a little surprised at how fast it really happened and how much the media really, really, really helped with that. The media really got on board with this and you were partly responsible for that, as you said. They liked the story and they spread it to millions and millions of people as well as the likes. So there's lots of people talking about testicular cancer, so it's great.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to touch on. I found you because I also work as a television news anchor in Global, and Global nationally ran a story on you. And here you are on our online program right now. How much media attention are you getting, and are you getting media attention beyond Canada?
We haven't had anything really beyond Canada, but we've had a ton in Canada, and that's ultimately all we could ask for. I mean, people are Skyping, or not Skyping, sorry, are emailing and tweeting people like Ellen and stuff like that. And if that was to happen, that would be amazing. But ultimately, because of you know, global national, that's reaching millions of viewers across Canada, and we've had several national interviews with different networks. I mean, ultimately, for me, this is about awareness, not money. So I'm really happy about the $50,000, and that's the goal. But when you have a new news team like Global cover something like this, that is so far and wide and so reaching far, and people are going to be talking about this. It's so exciting.
Now, when you're not at home in your underwear, where for the world to see, what is it that you do?
I have a couple of jobs. I work at the Second City as a server and front of house manager, and the Second City is a comedy club in Toronto, if people don't know. And I also work for the University of Toronto Med program, and basically what I do is I role play with med students and help teach communication skills. So I might role play that I'm sick, and so they have to diagnose it, or maybe I do a communications session or whatnot.
Now, that latter thing, that is also another fascinating job, and believe me, one I think we all need more of, because bedside manner can always be improved.
Yeah, and you know what? The new crop of doctors that are coming up there, and they go through, they deal with people that we're called standardized patients, and they deal with standardized patients from a very early time. They're really good at it now. They're really great at communication. I think that you're gonna see doctors in 10, 20 years really having patient-centered approaches to medicine, and it's going to be far different than what we've experienced in the past.
Now, as for the underwear, you are in your underwear every day for all to see online.
Yes.
How many hours a day is your link up and running?
24/7.
So
yeah. I have privacy in my bedroom and I have privacy in the bathroom. So when I go to bed, the cameras are still on down here, but there's really nothing to see unless I get up and grab a glass of water or walk through to go to the bathroom. But there are still there's an active chat room, so people are still in there chatting about the day or what happened, and it's a pretty interesting phenomenon, Peter.
Now, this is the time of year where it's getting a little chilly outside. You have to turn the heat up a little extra bit because you're just walking around your underwear all day?
You're a bright man. Yeah, it's pretty crazy some days. Guests will come over fully clothed and be like, man, what is going on here? Because it's like 90 degrees in here. Because the first day was a nightmare. I had to really crank the heat. You'd be surprised how much body heat you lose when you're naked all the time.
So do you wear a different style of underwear every day? Are you basically a Stanfield's living, breathing model?
Well, I'm definitely not. I wouldn't call myself. I'm not a spokesman for Stanfield's by any means. I'm just a guy that had testicular cancer that's been put in this situation. But you're right on in one way. I mean, I'm wearing a different pair of underwear, a different pair of Stanfield underwear every day. I'm going to come out and do a morning reveal in a new pair. Today I'm wearing some microfiber ones that are new on the market that are good for working out, because my personal trainer's coming, Peter, in 13 minutes to work me out.
Now, how did you hook up with Stanfield in the first place?
Well, I had done a PSA for the Canadian Cancer Society after my experience with testicular cancer. And when Stanfield's and the ad agency John Street were looking for someone that would be willing to do this, they were able to know about me because had been talking to the Canadian Cancer Society. So I was sort of being considered early on in the project. And then we just all got along and it seemed like it made sense for us to work together.
And you mentioned that there's a lot of comments. People talk to you online every day. What are the kinds of things they're talking about? And by the way, are you hearing from other people who went through similar situations as yourself?
Yeah, that's a good question. First off, I mean, I'm hearing from people all over the world, and that's amazing. I mean, Facebook has a far reach. And although all the media attention was in Canada, because of Facebook and going viral a little bit, I'm talking to people in South Africa, I'm talking to people in New Zealand and Ecuador and all sorts of crazy places. So people are active in chat all the time, and lots of time they're talking about what I'm wearing or what I'm cooking or silly fun stuff like that. But often it's about more serious issues, and it's about testicular cancer. Chat goes from serious to fun very quickly. And to the second part of your question, lots of testicular cancer survivors show up in chat, and it's really amazing. I love the fluffy stuff, and we have a good time in chat, but really ultimately when someone comes in and says, hey man, thanks for doing this, I'm a survivor as well, I'm with you, I'm passing the word on, that really means a lot to me.
You're all doing, you're doing this for a great cause, obviously, and you had no idea where this was going to take you once you started back at the beginning of the month, or at least on the 6th of October. But when all is said and done, what do you see happening besides the awareness that you've raised and, of course, the money? Do you see offshoots of this in your life, or a different career path, or being a greater spokesman for the cause, or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's been interesting is that although it's hard to live in the loft, I'm kind of as happy as I've ever been. And I think part of that is having a real sense of contribution and a real sense of purpose. I think myself in my day-to-day life, I always feel like I should be doing something else. Oh, I got to do this now. I got to do that now. Sort of never being present. But in here, I'm sort of forced to be present. And I have this awesome sense of contribution all the time. So I'm almost always in a good mood. So I think it would be crazy for me not to continue doing this in some way. I don't know how I will do it. I don't know how it will present itself. But I've always trusted my life will, you know, the opportunities will come as they will, and certainly this one did. So let's keep our fingers crossed that I get to do something that gives me a sense of contribution, hopefully to do with cancer and specifically testicular cancer.
You mentioned that your personal trainer is coming over in a few moments. How have you changed physically, and how do you think you'll change by the time 25 days are over?
Well, I mean, I haven't been perfect, but I've definitely had, you know, every once in a while I'll eat crap. But it's when you're in here and you're being watched constantly, the last thing I want to be doing is sitting around eating chips and drinking beer all day long. Now, that does happen sometimes. But I'm trying to eat a little bit healthier, trying to, you know, cook 3 meals a day. And Sal's been coming and working me out. We've had a yoga instructor come in as well and a few other things. Nothing's really changed yet, but I'm starting to have more energy, and that's the first step, and I feel a little stronger. So I'm gonna continue on after I get out of here and get myself back into shape. I let myself go a little bit after my surgery, and now it's time to reclaim it.
And what are you gonna do after the 25 days? What's the first thing you're gonna do when you get out of that house?
Well, I mean, besides the obvious, put on a pair of pants. I think it sounds cliched, but spend some time with family and friends for a couple of days and just get back connected into the real world. Walk. I'm a big walker, Peter. I love walking around, and this is kind of hard for me. I don't have like a local coffee shop that I love or anything. Like, I don't have those kind of habits. My habits are walking, and so I missed that a lot. So I'm gonna go for a big walk probably.
Well, congratulations on your cause and getting the word out. People can check the website at www.guyathome.com. Mark, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
It's my pleasure, Peter, and thanks so much for covering this. It's important to me, and I'm very appreciative.
Mark McIntyre from guyathome.com. Again, all you have to do is go to his website and hit the Facebook like button to drive those numbers up. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0062, and you'll find the links to Mark's website. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and we have time for one more item, and of course you know what that is. Yes, folks, it's the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Donald Denny and his father, also named Donald Denny, concocted a plan on the telephone for Dad to smuggle the son a ball of black tar heroin into his Colorado prison for eventual resale during visiting hours to be passed through the mouth by a deep kiss from a female visitor. However, Dad could not find a woman with a clean enough record to be admitted as a visitor. Wow, talk about the people they know. Still enamored of the plan, however, the father decided to be the drug mule himself and inserted the packaged heroin into his own rectum for later transferal to his mouth, even though that eventual deep kiss would be kind of awkward. The Dennys were apparently unaware, despite audio warnings, that all of his son's phone calls were being monitored, and in September, prison officials were waiting for the father with a body cavity search warrant as he entered the prison. Now, they have audio warnings telling people that all their calls are monitored. These people, at least one of them, is in jail. He should know what's going on. The father thinks he can sneak heroin into his own butt crack through the prison and then somehow get it to his son. There is only one reason why these two tried to commit this crime, while actually one of them was already in jail. And that reason? They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0062. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, it's 0062. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me at Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder, and on Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJMedia.com, aboard Taiwan's national carrier, China Airlines, and over the air at World FM in New Zealand, Gold FM in Singapore, and WSTJ, St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.